This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
A little over 20 years ago, a sociologist named James W. Lowen wrote a book exposing the inaccuracies and some outright lies in most history textbooks.
I watched this white supremacist BS being taught to all black classes by African-American teachers because they were just teaching what was in the book. History had been a weapon that it had been used against my students.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to Lowen about the latest edition of the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. We'll also spend an academic minute finding out if Mom really did like you best. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Since it was first published in 1995, James W. Lowen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, has sold about 2 million copies. This summer, a new edition of the book has been released, with a new preface written by Lowen for what he calls this, the Age of Alternative Facts. James Lowen is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Vermont and currently lives in Washington, D.C. I asked why it was time to revisit this book.
Well, we are in kind of a new era, and I don't say that just because of Donald J. Trump. Somebody famously said the first draft of history is journalism. Well, it used to be from, let's say, the major paper in whatever city you lived in. There's only a few cities that had more than one. But newspapers, as everybody knows, are in a much weakened state owing to the web. So that's not as important a source for most people nowadays. Instead, we have the Internet. Well, the Internet is great in some ways. It certainly allows lots of voices to speak, but they aren't vetted as well as, let's say, even newspapers were. And they're also not voices that bring us together. Everybody can find their own voice. You know, some people, and the same is true for cable TV now that we have 700 channels. The result is that everybody kind of has their own truth, and the line between truth and opinion gets blurred. So that's the first problem. And then we have a problem going on in academia, and it's been going on for more than 20 years, particularly in history and in the humanities. Here's a line I keep hearing in graduate school. Why should we privilege one narrative with the term true? In other words, that there's not exactly such a thing as a truth that we can all say is objective, and that's it. Well, I think that sounds very sophisticated and very nuanced, but I think it's actually too simple and not adequate. I reply, yeah, right. And the Civil War started in about 1875 in Nevada. It grew out of a pay dispute between the Chinese railroad workers and the Union Pacific. And people look at me like I'm crazy, which, of course, that statement is. And they say, but that's not true. And, of course, it isn't true. And there is a bedrock of fact. Does that help get to why I thought we needed a new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me?
It certainly does, especially given that in the book you talk about the Vietnam War. And, of course, I was alive. We were both alive during that. We both read press coverage of the Vietnam War. And yet, depending on which paper you read, you got a different story of the war. And then the government was telling a whole different one.
Well, that's true. Gradually, facts did emerge. It actually wound up being our most photographed war and the war that had the most journalism going on in it, because our Iraq war, or both of them, and our Afghanistan war, they have these embedded journalists, but they're kind of under their care and feeding, if you will, of the armed forces. And by definition, they see what they're shown. But in Vietnam, there are all these journalists just running around the place, you know, under nobody's control. And gradually, I think the truth came out. And in fact, if you look at public opinion polls on the war in Vietnam, you found that by the time the United States gets out, the vast majority of Americans believe that it was a mistake to have gone in and believe it was a mistake both morally and also politically, that is, in terms of our realpolitik, our national interest. It didn't do us any good. Interestingly, you look at what the textbooks tell us about Vietnam, and the further we get from it, it's not getting any better. It was terrible then, and it's even worse now. The textbooks are much worse than the journalism was.
Well, let's get into this. This book is not a rewrite of the original book, correct? This is just you put a new preface on this.
That's right. I did revise the book thoroughly in 2007. And in order to do that, I read six more United States history textbooks. People need to know that Lies My Teacher Told Me is based on my intensive reading of, by now, 18 high school history textbooks. I joke, but it's true. No one else has ever attempted this feat. I mean, they are so boring. I don't think teachers read them. Students sometimes have to read them, but I don't think anybody else does. I think they look at them. And one of my pieces of evidence for that was when I wrote the second edition in 2007, I came upon the fact that two of these six new books that I was evaluating by two completely different sets of authors had a chapter that was almost identical. It was identical for page after page. The photos were identical, the captions were identical, and the main prose text was identical, except one of them might have a very in it, and the other one didn't have the word very, like they had gone through two different sets of copy editors, but it was identical prose. So I called up the authors, Borsten and Kelly. Daniel Borsten was the chief librarian of the Library of Congress. That's a very important post. Brooks Mather Kelly was the chief archivist of Yale University. I called up Kelly. I couldn't call up Borsten because he had just died. And Kelly initially says, when I start asking about the new chapter, Borsten did it, by which he doesn't mean Borsten copied. He means Borsten wrote it. Pretty soon I tell him, did you know that for page after page, it's identical to this chapter in this other book called Pathways to the Present, written by four guys over at Miami University in Ohio. And he said, and I quote, oh, no, that's terrible. Pretty soon he admits that Borsten didn't write it. He said, Pennesall hired somebody to write it. I forget the man's name, which means here we have these two famous historians that put their name on a book, but they don't even know who wrote it or the qualifications of who wrote it, nor do they read it. So these folks, you know, when I give this lecture to college students, I say, now look, if you're stupid enough to buy your term paper for $9.95 off the web, I hope you at least have brains enough to read the darn thing before you hand it in to the professor. There's no quality control whatsoever. So the people writing the Vietnam chapter, they don't have any particular knowledge about it. They're not even necessarily historians. They may just have a BA in English.
When you wrote this book, when it came out, did you expect it to be as popular and as revolutionary as it was?
Well, in a way I did. I had the following – well, let me say this. For some reason, and I don't have a personalized fear of dying. A lot of people don't, it turns out. I know this because I once got into a discussion group at my church when I lived in Vermont, and there were about 25 people in the group, and we split about evenly of people who really do fear death and people who really don't. And I fit into that second group. But during the time that my teacher told me was almost out, I really worried when I descended in an airplane and we had rough weather or, you know, when anything threatening like that happened, because I really wanted to stay alive until it got out because I thought it would be good. My vision was, and I have no idea where this came from, that it would sell 116,000 copies in hardbound and be on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 weeks. Well, that's not quite what happened. What happened was it sold about 55,000 copies initially in hardbound. It never hit the New York Times bestseller list, but it did hit the bestseller list in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Boston, in various other places, and it's been the top seller in historiography, its category at Amazon, continuously from 1995 on, and so now it's sold close to 2 million copies. So I never had that dream. Historians actually kind of liked the book. And in fact, they recruited me to be a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, even though I'm a sociologist. Anybody, for instance, who teaches the Civil War likes what I say about the Civil War. They don't know anything about, let's say, Columbus, and I have a chapter about Columbus. But the people who teach about Columbus, they like what I say about Columbus. And they maybe learn something from what I wrote about the Civil War. You know, historians, unfortunately, like the rest of us in academia, are so split up that very few people know much about the whole sweep of American history.
You write that when the book came out, some teachers just, because of the title, rejected it out of hand.
One teacher did in particular, and I found this out because it was in Burlington, Vermont, and I used to live in Burlington. And by the time this escapade happened, I was living where I live now in Washington, D.C. But I did a workshop for K through 6 teachers, or maybe K through 5 teachers in Burlington. I didn't usually do workshops for kindergarten and first and second grade, but anyway. And there was one teacher who absolutely was upset that she had to go to this workshop and that the school district would offer one called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Well, the book does not bash teachers. I admit that the title does, but the book does not bash teachers. It's mainly an attack on textbooks. It is an attack on teachers if they only rely on the textbook. But it's not a teacher bashing book. So I did the workshop, and she vowed she would never read the book. And then I heard back from I knew people in Vermont, so I heard back from somebody who taught with her that she had been seen reading the book, but she put the cover of some other book on top of it so that nobody knew she was reading it.
All right. In summary, what do we get wrong about history? I mean, is there a common thread of the mistakes, or is it just all over the place?
There are a couple of common threads. It's not just random mistakes. There are plenty of just random mistakes, partly because, as I already noted, the people writing the books, they don't really care about it. I mean, their name isn't on it. They are just clerks deep in the bowels of the publisher, and the authors don't read the books, the so-called authors, the authors whose names are rented. So there are plenty of just random mistakes. I mean, one random mistake in a book that I did not review, an older book, but it became quite famous, had President Truman ending the Korean War by using nuclear bomb. Now, this would be news to Dwight Eisenhower, who campaigned for the presidency on the platform, among other things, that I will go to Korea and I will end this war. So that's a random mistake. But I think there's two kinds of general mistakes. First, the biggest overall mistake is that we Americans started out great, and we've been getting better ever since, kind of automatically. Everything's been getting better and better. Now, in some ways, that's true. There are some things that have been getting better, but almost everything has its ups and downs. And the downs, such as this era called the nadir of race relations, this is the period 1890 to about 1940, when race relations actually got worse all across the country. We can't even discuss them in the textbook because it doesn't fit with this overall narrative, which is everything always got better. So that's the biggest single lie, if you will. It didn't always get better, and it doesn't get better automatically. And then the second biggest, it's not exactly a lie, it's a problem. The textbooks don't want to say anything bad about anybody. Well, there's a couple of exceptions, but and my example that I give is Franklin W. Pierce. People say, who? Well, he, of course, was one of the presidents around the 1850s who that we don't remember very well. He was just before Buchanan. He was actually terrible. He's my candidate for the second worst president in the history of the whole country. He was a total pro-slavery Democrat, even though he's from New Hampshire. He was drunk during most of his presidency. All kinds of bad things happened during his presidency, some of which he deliberately caused. It was so bad that he's the only president in the history of the country whoever wanted to be renominated after winning election the first time, and his home party wouldn't renominate him. And when he got off the train in New Hampshire after his term of office, nobody met his train. That's how bad he was. Well, do textbooks say anything like what I just said? Well, no, because he's the only president New Hampshire ever produced. And so he has a very bland historical marker at the state capitol about this maybe kind of good president. There's a college named for him, blah, blah, blah. So if the textbooks can't tell us anything bad about Franklin W. Pierce, who can they tell us anything bad about? Nobody. And so as a result, that not only makes them wrong lots of times, it also makes them boring all the time.
Still to come, our conversation with James Lowen continues with this question. Why is history so important anyway? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. God Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is James Loewen, and we're talking about the new edition of his classic look at history education in the U.S. called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Why is history important in the first place?
Well, I'm a sociologist, so that question hit me upside the head because my first full-time teaching job was at a black college, Tougaloo College. It's over in Mississippi. Tougaloo is a very good college. It's a small college. Most folks haven't heard of it. I spent 7 years there. But my first year, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology. But I was also asked to teach and did teach one section of what they call the Freshman Social Science Seminar. And this was a course that was invented by the history department. And it used African-American history as its framework, which made sense since 99%+ of our students were African-American. And it introduced students to, you know, the drill, my discipline, sociology, anthro, poli-sci, psych, econ. And it, as I mentioned, did this in the framework of African-American history. Well, when you're in that framework, that's the same chronology as, shall we say, regular American history. So second semester starts not just after Christmas, but second semester starts also after the Civil War, with the period known as Reconstruction, of course. So I found myself with 17 new students that first day of class in January. I didn't want to do all the talking, so I asked them, okay, what is Reconstruction? What happened then? And 16 of 17 of my students told me Reconstruction was the period right after the Civil War, when blacks took over the government of the southern states. But they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. And I thought, I mean, that was kind of an aha moment, or maybe I should call it an oh no moment, because none of that happened. I mean, black folks never took over the southern states. All of the southern states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had white legislative majority as well. The Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they wrote the best state constitutions that the states have ever had, including better than the ones that they labor under today. Mississippi, in particular, had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century. There's just so many things wrong with that. Too soon out of slavery, there's a concept, as if slavery was trying to educate you, which it was not. It was a felony to teach blacks how to read or write, even free blacks during slavery. So I'm thinking, my God, how terrible it is to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up. Now, if it was true, that's a different matter. We have to figure this out, come to terms with it. But it didn't happen. In lectures, I call this an example of what I call BS. And everybody laughs, and I say, bad sociology. But, of course, it's bad history as well. And so I went to nearby schools, and this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South, including Mississippi. So I went to nearby black schools, high schools, and I watched this white supremacist BS being taught to all black classes by African-American teachers because they were just teaching what was in the book. So I realized that history had been a weapon, that it had been used against my students. And I eventually got a grant, and I put some people together at Tougaloo and also at Millsaps College, the nearby white college, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi, and we got it adopted by the state. That required a lawsuit because they refused to adopt it. They usually adopted 3 to 5 books in a given subject. In this subject, they only had two contenders, ours and theirs, but they rejected our book. So we sued them, and the lawsuit is called Loewen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. And we won, and we got it adopted, and any school district that wanted to use it and could avoid teaching this white supremacist history. But that taught me how important history was, because the state of Mississippi, the white supremacist state of Mississippi at the time, was taking it very seriously as a weapon to keep blacks down and keep white folks racist.
Well, my usual last question, I think I know the answer to, are things getting better? And I'll add, if they are, do you take some credit?
Well, I don't care. I'm not interested in credit for myself or not. I am interested in getting things better, both on two fronts, race relations and social justice, but also the front of historical accuracy. And I actually think that we are making progress, even in this Trump era, on both of those fronts, even though the president clearly is against both of them, which is really too bad, and not all Republican presidents have been. But I think the two are linked. That is, I think truth about the past helps us realize justice in the present. And I think the reverse is true, too. I mean, for example, one of the things I've written about, in fact, I have another book out in a reissue, Sundown Towns. These are towns across the North, mostly, that are all white on purpose, or used to be all white on purpose. Okay, I think telling the truth about these towns helps them today realize, gee, you know, maybe we might still have some race relations problems. An example of a sundown town that does have some race relations problems but isn't a sundown town anymore would be Ferguson, Missouri, for example. So I think truth about the past helps us be just in the present. And I also think that when we commit justice in the present, and my example there is toward Japanese Americans, you know, during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, we apologized to Japanese Americans for incarcerating them during the Second World War. We gave them each $20,000 as kind of a restitution. Well, that didn't exactly make it right, but it's the best we could do, perhaps, and it kind of makes it a success story. And now textbooks do a great job of telling about this because we're no longer ashamed of it. So I think that justice in the present helps us tell the truth about the past, too. And I think we're going to be making continuing progress on both of these fronts.
Again, the full title of James Loewen's book is Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. It's been reissued in hardcover and paperback by the New Press. Did mom really like your brother or sister best? Get ready, because that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do parents have a favorite child? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Lambrianis Nikifortis, assistant professor of marketing at SUNY Oneonta, explains how bias for the same sex may be what drives this decision.
Growing up, you may have suspected that one or both of your parents favored a sibling. Maybe it was an extra toy or occasional gift. Most parents believe that they treat their children equally, but is this true? Our research provides some of the first evidence that the biological sex of a child leads to systematic bias, with parents allocating more resources to the child who is the same sex as they are. Our prediction was that parents might favor the child of the same sex because they identify more closely with that child. This is consistent with the idea that people tend to spend money on things that align with their identity, and gift-giving to one's children can be a way for parents to bolster their sense of identity and live vicariously through their children. Most parents strongly deny favoring one child over the other, but they also admit they do not actively track investment in each child. This leaves room for bias. In one study, we asked parents in the United States and India to decide which of the children would receive a treasury bond. Mothers were more likely to choose their daughter, and fathers were more likely to choose their son, because they identified more strongly with that child. These same effects emerged in other family decisions, from the distribution of assets in a will, to selecting which child would participate in a drawing to win a back-to-school prize pack. In the case of the prize pack, 76% of women chose the girl, and 87% of men chose the boy. These findings have far-reaching implications beyond the traditional family structure. In single-parent or same-sex parent households, the ramifications of this bias can be even stronger, given that there is no opposite direction bias from the other parent to even things out.
That was Lambrianis Nikifortis of SUNY Oneonta. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.